This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Politician, can you make a right decision for all of us? For all of us. Politician.
No, my heart and I, welcome to Kōrero with the Councillor. Today, a very special guest, the Chief Executive, John Prendergast from Trust House. Welcome, John.
You're a thanks, AJ.
Thank you so much for joining me. It was a bit remiss of me, and I thought, who am I going to have in this section today? So yesterday I sent out the SOS call, sorry about that team, still learning, to John, and he said, yeah, of course I can come in and have a yarn. So I really appreciate you coming in at such short notice.
Happy to be here.
John, just for those that don't know you, could you just introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Okay, I'm a recent arrival, well, fairly recent arrival in the Wairarapa. I've been here just over 3 years, originally mostly from Southland, from Invercargill. And moved up here. I had 3.5 years in Wellington en route to Masterton, but happy to have landed here. And really enjoy Masterton and the Wairarapa, actually. It's a lot like, I say to people, it's a lot like Southland. People know each other and they're sort of pretty connected to each other. But this is warmer and it's got vineyards, so it's all good.
And we don't roll our R's quite as much?
No, we don't. No, I'm not a naturalised Southlander. I didn't arrive there till I was about 12, so I don't have that. But my three daughters, they certainly do.
They have the natural dialect of the South. I love it. Yeah. And John, did you come to Masterton specifically for your role?
Yes, for the role at Trust House. So when I was in Southland for 20 years, I was the Chief Executive of the Community Trust of Southland, which is different from Trust House, but a lot of similarities too, in that it's a community-owned, quite public-facing trust. Trust House does hospitality and housing, and the Community Trust of Southland used to own Trust Bank and sold it, and so had an investment fund, but it used to give grants out to the community each year. So there's a lot of similarities between the two. And most of my career has sort of been at that intersection of commerce and community. So I was an accountant originally. I'm still an accountant. I had 20 years as CEO of Community Trust of Southland. I had a couple of years as CEO of Presbyterian Support Services Southland. I had 3 or 4 years as CEO of the Catholic Archdiocese of Wellington. Mm. And now I've been here 3 years in this role. And each of them have been similar in that respect, that they are trying to achieve the right balance between operating commercially and for community benefit.
That's a really interesting intersect. And how did you come about knowing that, you know, there's a bit of you that probably likes to make a bit of money and there's a bit that likes to give money away? So
accidentally, like most things in people's careers, I suspect, that I studied accountancy at Varsity at Otago 40-something years ago now, a long time ago now, and started a career in chartered accountancy and public practice, and then I became a corporate receiver in New Zealand and overseas. And then I got a job as the Chief Financial Officer at Trust Bank Southland, and the bank got sold. And the owner of the bank was the Community Trust of Southland, and they sold it to Westpac and got this big check, $160 million landed in their bank account one day. And the Community Trust of Southland existed to look after that putia and then use the income from that $160 million to give grants for community purposes in Southland. So that was the first one that was sort of at the intersection. Outside of work, I was involved in lots of different community groups on boards of hospice and museums and those sorts of things. So I always had an interest in that.
Mm.
But that job, I went from Trust Bank Southland to become the CEO of the Community Trust of Southland, and that's where I was able to put my interest in finance and community together during the workday.
Yeah.
It's quite cool, actually.
It's a really interesting balance. And is there many jobs in New Zealand like this?
New Zealand's got a number of, well, quite a lot of what I call institutionalised philanthropy.
Mm.
So there's a community trust in each region. There's 12 of them around New Zealand. That each came out of the Trust Bank movement. So they each used to own their bank and it was sold. The only one that still owns their bank is the Taranaki Community Trust, TSB Bank, Toy Foundation, they're called now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of energy trusts around the country that used to own power networks, sold them, and so have a balance sheet that's got investment funds in it, and they give grants for community. There's licensing trusts. Mm. So there are a few.
Mm. And John, so when this role came up, what drew you to the Wairarapa and to Masterton and this role in particular? Apart from the wine?
Well, I hate to admit it, but I don't know that I'd ever been to Masterton before. I applied for this job, and Donna, my wife, was reminding me the other day that we actually drove to Masterton to have a look before I applied for the job. And we liked what we saw, so I applied for the job. It was the job itself.
Yep.
Because it's got some challenge. We've got sort of an historic portfolio of hospitality businesses and a portfolio of social houses, and both aspects of the business need some work.
Mm.
So there was some challenge in it. The prospect, we enjoyed Wellington, it's a great city to live in, but we quite like the prospect of moving back to a smaller centre as well.
Mm.
So that was a part of it.
Mm. And probably similar to your experience at Southland, you know, the community-wise.
Yeah. And that's my thing, really, is the community part of it. I love getting out and about in the community and doing stuff in the community. And this gives a vehicle to be able to do that.
Mm.
And sort of have the commercial aspect at the same time.
So yeah.
Good.
So, John, one of the things I was really interested in when I first met you, and I can't even remember exactly when it was, but you talked about Trust House and you talked about the significant investment in the housing. Mm. And there were two things that you said that really resonated with me. One was you couldn't believe the state of the facilities in some of the houses or the stock that you currently had. And secondly, that you wouldn't live there, so it wasn't acceptable for anyone else. And I thought, wow, for a chief executive to be that honest was really heartwarming, because when you've lived in the region for a while and you've seen assets deteriorated and you've seen our most vulnerable within positions that are not ideal, it was just a really challenge. But your response to that was, to me, I think, and others in the room, you said, it cost me this amount to renovate, so why on earth would I not just rebuild? And I thought, oh, like, I love this thinking. One, you're honest, and two, you're thinking longer term.
Well, I think we have to be honest. You know, we did a good thing back in 1999. I think we bought the State House portfolio, 541 houses. But then for a whole range of reasons, some valid reasons and some not so valid perhaps, but for whatever the reasons, we haven't reinvested back into that housing portfolio to the extent that we needed to maintain those houses in a state that we should be happy with. And they, not all of them, but a number of them sort of passed a tipping point where refurbishment, renovation wasn't going to do it.
Mm.
And it wasn't worth it economically to do it. And so rebuilding made sense. The big asset that we had was we had a portfolio, 500-odd houses, that we'd paid $10.5 million for 30 years ago. The value of that had grown to probably $120, $130 million over that time, just through the virtue of property inflation during that time.
Mm.
We'd repaid our mortgage, so we had a debt-free housing portfolio.
Mm.
And we realised that we thought, well, how are we going to rebuild? Because it's what we're doing. We're building 300 new houses and we're refurbishing 120 houses. It's about a $140 million project over a five-year term. We thought, how are we going to pay for that?
Mm.
And we realised that we could sell some houses. So we'll sell maybe 150, 160 of our houses. We've already sold 50 or 60 over the last couple of years. That'll raise about $60 million. We had no mortgage. We have now. I signed a month or so ago a $50 million mortgage facility with Community Housing Funding Agency. So that's $110 million of the $140. And then we will scrabble for government funding whenever and wherever we can.
Mm.
And that's quite challenging at the moment because there's not a lot of money going into housing from the government. It needs to be a higher priority for whatever government it is.
Mm.
And the Wairarapa hasn't been identified as a priority area. But despite that, we managed to get $10 million just before Christmas last year from the government.
Well done.
And we'll keep chipping away. Mm. We keep inviting the minister over. That's what we'll do. So we realised we could, because we had the existing asset, we could trade our way out of it.
Yeah.
And so in 2030, we'll have a portfolio, might be much bigger than what we started with in terms of number of houses, but 300 of the houses will be brand new and 120 will have been fully refurbished and there'll be another 60 or 70 waiting to be refurbished. Oh. So it'll be quite transformational for us as the owner of those houses, but particularly for the tenants as the occupants of those homes. And we say often that Trust House owns the houses, but they're our tenant homes.
Mm.
And so our biggest challenge in the rebuild isn't necessarily the physical building of the new houses. It's looking after the tenants on the way through.
Yeah.
Because one way or another, almost all of our tenants are going to experience some form of disruption, dislocation. Mm. It's interesting, you go to people and say, we want to knock your house over and rebuild new houses on this site.
Mm.
And where we might have a 3 or 4 bedroom old house on a quarter acre section, we'll knock that over and we might build 4 or 5 2-bedroom houses on that section. And most people, when we tell them that, they're over the moon that they're going to get a new house.
Mm.
Some people are really upset because they like their old house. They've been in that house for 50 years, some of them.
Yeah.
And we get that. So that's the challenging part of this, is managing them carefully through the transition.
Yeah.
But we're underway. We've got our first 16 new houses finishing next week, so they'll be tenanted in the coming weeks. We've got our next 66 new houses under construction, so that middle of next year we'll have 66 more new ones ready to tenant. We're at procurement right now for another 22 in Marchbank. We're doing due diligence across 4 sites for the next 43, some of them down Colombo Road by the Netball Centre down there. So that'll get us to about 150, so 104. So about a third of the way towards the 300. And then we're busy doing the planning work for the next 196.
God.
So we can do it, and we're on track to do it.
Yeah.
We're trying. The ones that we sell, there's quite good stories with a lot of those. Some of them have gone to first home buyers because they're in that lower cost part of the market.
Yep.
So that's good. Some of them have been bought by tenants' families.
Oh, wow. What a cool story.
Five of them. And what's happened is that families have come to us and said, we know that you're looking at selling some houses.
Mm.
Don't know if mum or dad's house is one of them, but we'd like to buy it for them. And so that's what happened. So we give them a small discount to buy it because they're existing tenants. It's their house, it's their home.
Yeah.
So we've got first home buyers buying them, some tenants buying them. We've got some landlords buying them. So they're still in the system.
Yeah.
They're not been put on the back of a truck and taken somewhere else.
Houses in Masterton. And John, tell us about what you're seeing, the changes in the portfolio, and you referred to, maybe your stock when you talk about the way we used to live on big quarter acre section and everyone had a yard and everyone had lawn and veggie gardens, and the change in the way that we live now and the need for different size accommodation, whether we're going from 5 bedrooms or 4 bedrooms to 2. What are you seeing and what are you developing in that space?
What we're seeing is a big bow wave of older people that are lifetime renters. So it used to be the great Kiwi thing that you bought a house, you paid your mortgage off, and by the time you arrived at retirement age, you had a freehold house.
Mm.
And that provided you some cushion financially for your retirement.
Mm.
By 2040, more than 50% of Kiwis will arrive at retirement as renters, don't own their own home. So there's been a marked change in that whole Kiwi dream, if you like, to own your own property.
Yeah.
Big shift to lifetime renting. So there is a real need for rental housing for older people. And so whereas our portfolio had been predominantly three-bedroom, some four-bedroom, we had one five-bedroom house in the portfolio, only one. Our new houses will be predominantly two-bedroom, some one-bedrooms, and some five-bedrooms as well, because we've seen quite a bit of intergenerational living.
Yeah.
Particularly, but not only, but particularly amongst Pacifica families. So the 16 that we're building now that are finishing this week, three of those are five-bedroom. Four are one-bedroom. What's that? That's seven. And nine are two-bedroom. And in the 66 that are under construction, most of them are two-bedroom with some ones as well. So we're seeing smaller houses. The big asset we have is that we own a lot of houses with big sections.
Yeah, got a lot of land.
So we've got a lot of land. We don't have to pay to buy the land again because we've already done that. So we can take a three- or four-bedroom house off and redevelop more intensively with smaller houses, but not trying to jam every last house we can onto the section because people are going to live in them.
Yeah.
So we're not going multi-storey, for example, because the houses need to sit in the context of the community we're building them in. And this is Masterton. You don't see a lot of tower blocks sort of in Masterton. It's not Birmingham or a big metro area. So most, well, all single levels at this stage, no multi-level. And trying to build in community spaces within the new developments. So, and we're learning from each batch of new houses that we do. And I think improving with each new batch of houses that we do. So no, it's going. Housing's going very well, actually.
It's interesting. We had an update from Matt from Marsden District Council around Inframetrics for our long-term plan last week, and not surprisingly, we're living longer, and not surprising, our ageing population, and actually the growth in the Marsden area is in our ageing population, but our over 80s, and I thought that was really interesting. And so, you know, the intentionality around we need to be building for those people, single level floors, one and two bedroom place, just makes absolute sense. And I think the other point you made around the significant shift from communities or whānau being able to own their own home and then having a freehold home versus having a lifetime of rental and then living on a fixed income at the end of that and still trying to make ends meet. And John, I just wanted to ask you around the rent, because I see you get a lot of criticism around rent affordability. Could you just explain how Trust House sets its rent and what opportunities people have for subsidy and support?
So of our 470 houses at the moment, 270 of them have income-related rent subsidy, IRRS subsidy from the government, which means that the tenants have financial hardship such that the government has met the government's criteria to be eligible for the rental support. So what that means is that we, as a community housing provider, we charge whatever the market rate rental is. The tenant, the income-related rent subsidised tenant, pays no more than 25% of their income in rent, and the government pays the balance, whatever that balance is, to us as the landlord. So we get market rent, the tenant gets subsidised, and the government picks it up. The government earlier this year announced that that 25% cap on how much rent, how much of their income a tenant would pay in rent, it's increasing to 30%. Which doesn't sound a big increase, 25 to 30%, but it's actually a 20% rent increase for the tenant. They're going from paying no more than 25% of their income to now paying 30% of their income. So it's quite a big jump, and that's due to come into effect mid-part of next year. And it'll be interesting to see if that survives the election, that proposed policy. Some of the other parties have said they don't agree with that increase. So that's for 270 of our tenants. And our market rents, because of the quality of the portfolio, as it has been, are at the lower end of market rents. The other 200 houses are tenanted by people that don't have that government subsidy. So they're what we call our affordable rentals. And we've got a whole mix of people in there, partly because for a long time we didn't means test people going into trust house houses. So within those 200, there will be a cohort that probably would qualify for government subsidy but haven't been through the process to get it. So we're working with them individually to try and migrate them to a government subsidy. There are also some who, an example I can think of, mum and dad and two little kids in one of our houses 30 years ago. Fast forward 30 years, mum and dad are still there and the two little kids are still there, but they're bigger kids now. All four of them are earning income.
Working kids.
Working kids. So they've got four incomes coming into that household, but they're still paying subsidised rent.
Mm.
So we are moving some of that type to full market rent. So, yeah, there's quite a mix because the government is subsidising the 270 income-related rent subsidy ones, but the Masterton and Wairarapa community essentially is subsidising any subsidisation that occurs for the other 200.
Mm.
And if that's warranted, good. Mm. That's part of what we can and should do as a locally owned trust.
Mm.
But if there's no financial need for it, then we will look to change that.
Mm.
So the advent of rebuilding the portfolio does give us reason, I guess, to reassess the circumstance of every one of our tenants.
Yeah.
And some of them, most of our existing tenants will migrate to new houses with us. Some won't. So not everyone will, because some of them don't have the financial need anymore. So the other thing we're looking at is retirement villages. So some people, when they get to a certain age, decide to sell their family home, cash up, and buy a unit, an occupational right agreement in a retirement village. And they go and live in the retirement village, they pay a weekly fee, and when they leave the retirement village, they get their original money back, less about a 30% deferred maintenance fee. They don't share in any capital gain.
Mm.
And it's reasonably expensive to get into retirement villages. We suspect there are a lot of people own their own home. If they sold it, they wouldn't get enough to be able to move into a retirement village. So what happens to them? So we're looking at another product. So we've got our social housing, subsidised by the government. We've got our affordable housing at the moment. But we're increasingly looking at things like a shared equity product, where we might build a house and then sell half of it to someone that's just sold their family home, can't quite get to a retirement village, but could get to a slightly lower cost model. Especially if someone else owns 50% of it. So we would own 50%, they would own 50%. When they left, they might well share in any capital gain. But it's a lower cost access to still owning your own home, or part of your own home, but freeing up some of your capital
as well,
as a source of income during your retirement. So we're looking at those sorts of models.
Really interesting. Having an 82-year-old flatmate and my father, we've done the rounds as well and had a look, and you're exactly right. You know,
it's not cheap.
No, and we're in
and they have great services.
Absolutely.
That comes at a price.
And then you think you can get in potentially by selling your home, but then you're on a fixed income for the weekly charges that come with that, and then what's your lifestyle look like?
Yeah.
It might be that as well. And also reflecting on the government funding for some of your stocks as well, that increase will have impacts on our community. But just to confirm, Trust House pay the rates and the insurance, the tenant pays their rent and then their power, etc., which are things that are also going up as well. So while they've got an increase on their expectation to pay the the difference in the rent that's come from the government, there's also those other things coming as well.
One of the things we've been looking very closely at with our new builds is the possibility to put solar panels on the roof. But at the moment, there's almost a disincentive for a landlord to install solar, because the landlord, so Trust House, for example, we can install solar. It might cost $15,000 or $20,000 per house. Mm-hmm. We don't get the financial payback for it because the tenant gets that and a cheaper power bill, which is great for the tenant, but it doesn't finance our extra cost in doing that. So the only way we could recoup that additional cost would be to increase the rent, which is sort of counterintuitive when you trying to provide low-rent housing. So we're talking with government and with all the political parties about, well, how might that be overcome?
Yeah.
So the houses we're building at the moment, and the ones, for example, that are finishing this week, they don't have solar on the roof, but we have structured them so that they're capable of taking solar. So we could go back and retrofit solar to the roof if and when the price of solar comes down, and it's coming down all the time, or if and when there was some government incentive for perhaps social housing providers to put solar on the roof. Because from every aspect you look at it, it makes sense.
Yeah.
From an environmental perspective, from an economic perspective for the tenants, it makes sense.
Yeah, but just your commercial return from a capital investment, that just doesn't,
right.
So if you could work out that,
Well, and the other thing is we own a little power station as well, ironically.
What?
We own a little hydroelectric power scheme out at...
Oscarterton, is this your...
No, out east in Cororo. There's a big, like a big chimney.
Yes,
That's our power station. We own a little dam with a hydroelectric scheme on it. And it generates enough electricity to provide power for about 400 houses. But we can't at the moment make the connection between the electricity that we're generating and our 400 or 500 houses.
Is the location?
It just goes into the grid.
Yeah.
But that whole landscape's changing too, so we're working on that. So there are possibilities in the future that we could be a little our own electricity provider.
Great. What an interesting and diverse portfolio that you have. And isn't solar a bit of a political and lead up to the election? Absolutely. You know, like,
everyone's getting into
exactly. Yeah. Oh, and then
there's a guy, Mike Casey, in Cromwell. He's got a cherry orchard there, and it's all electric. He doesn't have any solar-powered machines on it. His father is Simon Casey, who's a councillor at Cardin District Council.
Is it really?
And they both have this passionate interest in solar and electrification rather than using fossil fuels. But Mike's done great work advocating and lobbying to get more and more things electrified rather than using solar.
Electricity.
Fossil fuels.
So
that's a real area of interest for us.
Yeah.
And Mike was in the Wairarapa last year speaking at an Electrify Wairarapa conference.
Yeah.
And he's really good, actually.
I just wanted to touch on, in a previous life, I worked at Marston District Council. My portfolio had the senior housing, but it also had our wider housing portfolio. So while we're talking about Trust House, it's quite common for people that have housing portfolios to have different requirements and needs. So we have our social housing in terms of elderly housing at council, but we also had a stock of bits and pieces that council had acquired or purchased along the way. And similarly to you, those were things that we set at market rent because they were market property. And for example, Panama was bequeathed to the council, and that was for low socioeconomic communities and elderly people. So there was a caveat over what we could do. But then there was other bits and pieces, like some properties at the side of Queen Elizabeth Park that came with Queen Elizabeth Park that we were able to rent out, but they were more of our commercial nature of our business. So just wanted to acknowledge sometimes you get hammered around the rents and why are you doing this and why isn't everything at little or lower cost, but it's quite common for businesses or organisations, and whether they're community ones, local government or a local trust, to look at their stock and say, actually, these ones are more commercial. And then the same conversation that you're having around acquisition of land and then disposal of land. So actually it would make sense for us to purchase this piece of land. It's a strategic neighbour of this piece of land. It would make sense. Or actually this is hanging out in the middle of nowhere. We're not really sure why we got it.
And we've
Let's
been doing both
that.
Of those things.
Yeah.
Because we're looking at our whole portfolio and looking at which are the future potential development sites and which ones aren't.
Yeah.
And the ones that aren't, when those houses become vacant. And we have about a 15% turnover each year of tenants, just through natural people move away or people might die.
Mm.
And so we're not going and knocking on current tenants' doors and saying, we've got to sell your house, move out.
Mm.
We're waiting until the house becomes vacant and then we make a decision about, is this one that features on a future as a future development site?
Mm.
If it does, then we'll hang on to it. Is it one that we should refurbish and return into the stock? If that's the case, we do that. Or is it neither of those two things? And if not, then we'll look to sell.
Mm.
So we're selling some. We're also acquiring some.
Mm.
So we bought one recently in Masterton that was on the corner of a site that we owned that was one of our development sites. And it just squared off the whole site, gave us two frontages, and it made sense to buy it. So occasionally we're buying houses. I quite often get calls from people that own a block of land saying, would you be interested in buying our land to develop new housing? And generally the answer is no, because we've got enough properties of our own already, so we don't need to buy more land. And the only way we can make the economics of the redevelopment work is by utilising the land that we already own.
But and that you've paid for.
Exactly, yeah, and we have. Thanks to Wairarapa Building Society mortgage in 1999 of $10.5 million.
God.
So it was a very Wairarapa story, actually. It's interesting, in 1998, someone from the Masterton Licensing Trust, as it was at the time, got a phone call from someone in government asking if they'd like to buy the state housing portfolio in the Wairarapa and Tararua. And the Masterton Licensing Trust looked at it and decided, yes, they would. So that's how we come to own the houses that we do. Exactly the same time, I was the CEO of the Community Trust of Southland in Invercargill, and I got a phone call from someone in government asking if our trust would like to buy the state housing portfolio in Invercargill and Southland. And I looked at it and couldn't figure out how we could make it work financially. So we declined the offer. And now, 30 years later, I wonder which of us was right. I think Masterton was right.
It's a sliding doors moment.
It is. It really was, actually.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, in fact, increasingly I'm convinced that Masterton made a good decision to buy them because it's given us the portfolio that we can now redevelop and provide really improved housing outcomes for people. And it makes such a difference to people. If people have good, warm, dry, secure tenure, efficient housing.
Absolutely.
To their education, to their health, to the stops them breaking the law again. All of those social indicators.
Yeah.
It improves them all. And that's why I'd like to see a lot more government funding put into housing.
Mm.
I'd just like to see housing raised as a priority across whatever government it is. Because, I mean, government at the moment has committed $290 million for social housing for the next 5 years across the whole country, $290 million for 5 years. Our little trust in Masterton spending $140 million in the next 5 years ourselves doing it. So
it's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, it doesn't go anywhere at all.
Yeah.
So, but I know that we're in difficult financial times.
Yeah.
But there just has to be more money in the system if they want to really address the housing issue.
Yeah. And tell me, I completely agree. And the thing that I get frustrated about is the change in government, and then we throw out everything everyone else did, whether it's good, bad or ugly. It's just because those guys pissed me off and I'm not going to do anything that they said, whether it was right or not.
It can't be a good idea.
Exactly. And so there's this piece of work that Kieran is doing around the infrastructure. Does housing sit in that infrastructure, which is cross-party?
I think it should. I am a bit encouraged by, probably because I watch Kieran and Chris Bishop on breakfast every Thursday morning.
Yeah.
But there is quite a lot of crossover and agreement between those two around the need for a bipartisan approach
exactly.
to infrastructure, and I hope housing as well.
Yeah.
There was a bit of a previous Labor government had a focus on supporting Kāinga Ora, and not so much community housing providers like us. This government has got a stated preference for supporting community housing providers rather than Kāinga Ora, and they keep slagging off Kāinga Ora all the time. But there's got to be room for both.
That's right.
And so I would hope that in the future there is a bit of a balance between the two.
Yeah.
There is a need for both. I mean, we essentially were Kāinga Ora in the Wairarapa.
That's right.
Because we bought their portfolio 30 years ago. They left.
Yeah.
And we were it.
Yeah.
Kiera and McInulty managed to get them back into the Wairarapa early 2020s. And they built 70 or 80 new houses. Mm. But now that's stopped. So, but that has helped because they built houses, they increased the supply of houses in the Wairarapa, and that's given us a bit of leeway to be able to redevelop our portfolio. Because as we redevelop, the availability of houses that we can offer is going to shrink for a little while.
Yes.
While we knock houses over and sell houses and build them, because you can't do it overnight, obviously. So it's an interesting picture.
Now, John, tell me, the other part of the work that you do is hospitality establishments, which you touch on. That might take up a little bit of your time too.
It does, yeah, public houses and social housing. It's hospitality is just hugely challenged everywhere in New Zealand. I saw a stat yesterday that insolvencies in hospitality sector were up 42% last year.
Wow.
And in the last 12 months, I think it's 3,000 hospitality businesses across New Zealand have closed. So it's really, really challenged. By a few things, the economy and hospitality tends to be a bit of a canary in the coal mine, that if times are tough, the first thing that people stop doing is that discretionary spend, and hospitality is a total discretionary spend, so they stop going out. They don't go to the bars, they don't go out for dinner, they might go to the bottle store instead and buy a box of beer or a case of wine. And that hasn't recovered since before COVID, really. The economy hasn't recovered. So there's that. But there's also societal change going on. People are drinking less alcohol, young people particularly, drinking less. And that might be a combination of economic type times, but also I think young people just drink less. I look at my daughters, they just drink less, which is a good thing from all sorts of perspectives. But if you're a hospitality operator, it makes making the numbers add up challenging.
So we've
been having a very hard look at our hospitality operations and trying to optimise them as much as we can. In the midst of that, we opened the Horseshoe Tap Room last year, and that's gone really well. So there are some bright spots in there. And as we come into summer, that will help. And if we come into improved economic times, that will help. But, yeah, it is an industry that is challenged.
I think, I think about my own behaviour as well. Dad often says to me, we used to go to the accountant. He was a builder by trade for years, and Mum and him would go to the accountant. And if they got good news from the accountant, that was their annual outing where they went out for a meal. And if they had bad news, they went home and there was no out. And
no
so,
outing.
Yeah, so yeah. Sometimes when I say every couple of weeks, should we go out for dinner, Dad? It's quite a foreign concept.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, but one of the things I think the hospitality sector has actually done quite well. When I go to the supermarket, I find it far more horrific than when I go out for meal. I feel like I get better value for money when I go out for a meal and someone prepares it, and I know your overheads of staff and electricity, versus when I walk out of the supermarket with my $120 worth of milk and flour and maybe the odd bit of meat.
It's in one or two bags.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think our hospitality sector's done quite well at managing its costs, but it comes at a cost to the business, right?
It does, yeah. So, yeah, it's two interesting challenges, the housing portfolio, trying to renew that, and the hospitality portfolio, trying to make sure that it remains a viable thing.
Yeah.
And it's, it is tough.
John, I've just checked on the time and I know that you've got somewhere to be. And that went so quickly.
We're done.
We're 38 minutes over our 30. So if you're comfortable, John, I might get you back and we'll talk hospitality and grant funding if you can.
Yep.
But just a very big thank you. I've been really impressed with your mahi and I have the pleasure of sitting on the Ko Te Aroha board where you're the unofficial board chair and I'm just the figurehead.
I'm not.
But I really appreciate your contribution to the community, both in work capacity, but all that you do in a voluntary and social capacity too, and just the heart that you bring. I just found it really refreshing, and I know that you genuinely care, and that's what makes communities like Masterton the places that they are, particularly in leadership roles like you have. So thank you, John.
Thank you, AJ.
Appreciate you coming in.
No problem at all.
Politician, can you make a right decision?